and thank you for coming on this rather damp night. I thought I'd say a little about the genesis of the book, and perhaps even a little about the genesis of my own interest in the subject. I suppose I was first made aware of the existence of Zionism and the problems created by Zionism before the establishment of the state in 1948, when at Highgate School we used to listen to a wonderful drama each evening called Dick Barton, Special Agent. And after this was the news, but we all went off to have our baths. And I remember vividly at the end of one particularly dramatic Dick Barton, the news began, and the next thing I knew I was underneath a pile of very angry fellow schoolboys, and this happened to be the news item of the murder of the two sergeants by Jewish terrorists in Palestine. And so though I could only have been about 10 years old at the time, it certainly caused me to start thinking. And according to one schoolboy whose memory is probably better than mine, I was rather a pugnacious defender of those who had perpetrated the crime, something which certainly I would not be today. I also remember vividly my father taking me down to Manchester Square in May 1948 to see the Israeli flag fly from the new Israeli legation. We had many debates at school on Zionism, and just as in my Churchill hat, I recall the masters being deeply divided as to whether Churchill was the greatest man of the century or the most evil figure in the century, something which I see David Irving persists in arguing. Similarly, there were many arguments about the then very young Jewish state. This was before the war of 1956, so it was literally in its first 2 or 3 years. I wanted to go there when I left school. I made my way overland and got as far as the Turkish port of Iskenderun, and indeed found an American captain, ship's captain of a small merchantman, which was going to Haifa that night, and he agreed to take me, and who knows if I would ever have come back had I gone on that ship. A number of my school friends had emigrated the year before. But for better or for ill, the price which he wanted to exact for taking me on his ship from Iskenderun to Haifa was rather personal and unpleasant, and I ran out of his room in the hotel and disappeared into the east of Turkey. In 1967, I was working in the Churchill team of Randolph Churchill's on the biography. And he phoned up very late one night. I was then at Oxford, and he said, "We're writing about the war." And I said, "I know we're writing about the war. I'm deep in the naval attack at the Dardanelles at the moment, and I'm coming down in 3 days' time to bring you my notes." He said, "Don't be a bloody fool. The war that's just begun in the Middle East is what we're now writing about." And he had indeed taken on a commission to write a history of the 67 war, and so all his researchers were then suddenly listed to drop the Churchill research and to help him with his book on the 1967 war. And my task, which he communicated in a second phone call at about 4 a.m., was to write what he called the chapter one, the history of the Jews from Moses to Nasser, in 4,000 words. And if you could bring it with you, dear boy, in 2 days' time, I'd be very grateful. And it does rather focus the mind when you have that sort of instruction. It was interesting working on that because his son was then a journalist who was in the Middle East, and the nature of Randolph Churchill's researches was basically telephonic, and this meant phoning commanders-in-chief and generals on all sides and political figures, and my job was to listen in on the telephone and take the notes. And one or two of those notes appear in the book, you know, discreetly, disguised form. I remember particularly General Marquis, the liberator of Jerusalem, seemed to have to break off the battle 5 or 6 times to talk to Randolph Churchill, but did so with a good grace, and very sadly died earlier this year, just before his own memoirs came out. The result was that I started work on my Atlas of Jewish History, which is still in print and updated every few years. So I got something out of that strange other war experience. And I also corresponded with a number of Israeli figures in doing my Atlas, including David Ben-Gurion. And one of the things which he wrote to me about appears in the book, and that is in 1946, when the British authorities in Palestine arrested the whole of the Jewish Agency executive, and indeed some 400 or 500 leading Palestinian Jews, including Rabin, father and son. Ben-Gurion happened to be in Paris at the time. He was the chairman of the executive, and was of course very dejected, both by the arrest for his colleagues and by the setback which it implied in the evolution of some form of Jewish statehood. And in the same hotel that he was staying was a very upbeat and elated Ho Chi Minh, who believed wrongly that he was on the verge of gaining almost independence for his people. And they talked, and Ho Chi Minh was sympathetic to this very depressed and miserable fellow, and came up with the brilliant idea of abandoning Palestine and bringing the Jews of the world to Vietnam. And Ho Chi Minh even showed Ben-Gurion on the map the highland areas which would be most suitable. And although previous Zionists of one sort or another had flirted or been drawn into alternative Zions, including of course the El Arish and later the Uganda schemes which the British government promoted, Ben-Gurion declined this one. My own first visit didn't come until 1971, and I lived with the writer Amos Elon, whose work some of you may know, who was one of the very first Israelis to start a dialogue with his Egyptian opposite numbers, with Egyptian writers, and he produced a book about that dialogue. And Amos Elon was then living. He had moved after the 67 war to what is called East Jerusalem, and he did so in order to build, as he hoped, bridges with the Palestinian Arabs, and indeed insisted only on eating and talking and writing in Ramallah and Bethlehem. And I put this in the book, and also his wife's sad reflection about how that whole dream of 1970-71 collapsed, but it was a very real one at the time. And I remember vividly meeting a number of Palestinian Arab intellectuals and writers, poets, who shared that aspiration of that time. I also curiously returned, I'd never met Ben-Gurion before, but I went to see Ben-Gurion during that visit, and I bring in the book something which he told me, which made a great impression on me, and that was how when he was making his decision, which probably if he did nothing else was the important historic decision that he made to declare statehood, perhaps a decision that Yasser Arafat will make tomorrow or in a year's time. But when Ben-Gurion was making this decision, there were many pressures against him to do it, and the particular pressure was the, as was put in by the his military advisors, the vulnerability of Israel if it were to do so, both regionally and internationally. He told me that he kept thinking of his experiences in Britain in 1940, when British vulnerability was as great, a different sort of vulnerability perhaps, but he was here, he experienced the Blitz and the total isolation of Britain. And indeed, since I'm talking in Hampstead Bookshop, he told me that he had he was staying then in Church Row, flat in Church Row, for a few weeks, and he couldn't sleep, and he went to the bookshop and he bought a Greek New Testament and spent the sleepless nights translating it into modern Hebrew. I returned to Israel when I was working on the volume 4 of the Church of Oz, which covers Churchill's period as Secretary of State for the colonies, when he went out there and when he involved himself in the whole implementation of the Balfour Declaration, interpretation and implementation. And I'd never, I'd only been to Israel twice, 71 and 72. And of course I'd never been there during a religious holiday or holy day. And my scholarship, I had a scholarship to go for 2 weeks, and I managed to get it extended for 3 weeks, the third of which would be in Amman. The king very kindly said I could come and study his archives there. And I said to my wife, I see that the Day of Atonement is just before the scholarship begins, and to go out and have that experience in Israel. So we went out and we arrived in time for the Day of Atonement, but it was 1973, and indeed 24 hours after landing, the war began. And I use my diary quite a lot in that chapter in the book. And obviously that sort of experience does have enormous effects and ramifications. One effect on me was that I prepared and wrote my Atlas of the Arab-Israel Conflict. But more importantly, I decided that I'd write a history of Israel. Rather a precocious thing to do, but I thought I'll do that. I'll set aside my Churchill work and I'll publish it on the 30th anniversary of independence in 1978. Well, those of you who are writers know it's terribly hard to write and fulfill one's aspirations. And anyway, this is the book which should have come out in 1978. But I started collecting material then, and also I felt I should try to meet some of the people who were involved in Israeli policy. And as you know, there never really was a moment in the history of Israel since 48, and this is reflected in the book, there never was a calm moment. I'm not talking about wars, which took rather a small amount of the actual time, but calm and contentment and lack of conflicts of one sort or another. And when I was, I went back in 1975 to work on this book, and it was at the time of the United Nations resolution condemning Zionism as racism. And I went to see the Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, and was fascinated by his perspective, and this really is probably central to the theme of my book, because he put to me in 1975, and I use my notes in the book, he put to me something which I'd never really heard from an Israeli, and was not to hear again until he became Prime Minister in 1992, and he set this out to the Knesset. And that was that Israel is not a privileged country, and it's not a country which can claim that the world owes it something, or that it has to be treated any differently to any other country in terms of what it does, in terms of its state policy. And at that time, I must say, I was extremely impressed and surprised by this. Rabin had a reputation, although he's already Prime Minister, had been ambassador in Washington, of being essentially a military man. And this arose because he said, although Zionism is racism, is libelous and unacceptable, and indeed, of course, the British government would not vote for that resolution in 1975, nevertheless, he said, there are elements of racism in our makeup and in our relationship with the Arabs, and we have to fight against it, and so on and so forth. So this was an unusual perspective. But the most unusual was not so much the racism aspect, because that was a debate at that time, but this idea that Israel was not owed anything by the world, whether it was because of the Holocaust or whatever else, that it was like any other nation, or ought to be, as he put it very emphatically to me, and again in 1992, it had to be judged entirely on what it did, not on any claims it had to the world community. I started the book in the mid-19th century, and I've given considerable weight to the things that happened up to 1948. This is what I wanted to do. I suppose in theory one could have begun a history of Israel, chapter 1, in May 1948. just as I once began my history of the Second World War on the 1st of September 1939. It's something that you can decide to do and bring in your reflections and retrospections and origins in the course of the subsequent unfolding of the story. But in this case, I felt for various reasons it was very important to establish what had happened up to 1948. First of all, the question of whose land and the so-called conflicting pledges, the McMahon letters, the Balfour Declaration. And I go into this in some detail. I was drawn into this whole question of what was promised to whom by a fascinating exchange of letters between Churchill and McMahon himself when Churchill was Colonial Secretary in 1921, and a Palestinian Arab delegation had come to London and had protested to Churchill that the McMahon correspondence promises had not been fulfilled in respect of Palestine. And Churchill wrote to McMahon and said, you know, I'd like you to clarify this, and in particular, I'm puzzled in reading the correspondence, because after all, Churchill's an intelligent man, he traveled with the world and knew things, so I'm puzzled in reading the correspondence that you make no reference to Jerusalem in it, if you remember it. It's the layouts of Hama, Homs, Damascus, Aleppo. And McMahon wrote back and said, the reason why I didn't include Jerusalem in my letter is that I could think of no place of particular importance to the Arabs south of Damascus. But of course that changed, and one of the things I show in the book, I think it's quite an important part of the book, is the role of the Mufti, who often appears as a villain in many histories, the Haj Amin al-Husseini, the way in which Haj Amin really raised the status of Jerusalem. He was a brilliant publicist, of course he was more than a publicist, but he first of all travelled the Muslim world in the 1920s, arguing the case for greater centrality of Jerusalem, and indeed of Palestine, and then more importantly was able to persuade leading Islamic figures to come to Jerusalem to, as it were, associate their knowledge, their experience, their dignity and seniority with what he was trying to do. So in a curious way, between McMahon and 1948, there was a sea change which was reality. I also show in the book the extent to which Palestinian Arab anti-Zionism preceded even the First World War. I found material relating to the elections for the Ottoman Parliament, the last elections for the Ottoman Parliament before the outbreak of the First World War, in which the two successful Palestinian Arab candidates both campaigned on what could be called an anti-Zionist platform, an end to Jewish immigration in 1912, a total halt to Jewish immigration, and they were successful. I think all historians and all history has a fascinating retrospective element to it. But when I started writing this book in 1974, 1975, the agreement which was signed by the M.F. Faisal and Chaim Weizmann at Aqaba was a curiosity. Nothing came of it. The emir offered to recognize the situation of the Jews and the predominance of the Jews in Palestine in return for Dr. Weizmann offering the services of the Zionist movement to the Arab cause. The emir offered to encourage a substantial Jewish immigration, not to oppose it and so on. And it was a curiosity. And then, by one of those strange quirks of history, the very dramatic signing of the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty took place on the very same site, a few miles north of Aqaba. And among those present was the nephew of the Weizmann who had negotiated with Faisal, and Faisal's great-grandson. So it was quite an extraordinary thing. But the Faisal-Weizmann agreement, and the content of it, is, I think, important. And particularly important when it took place at a period when there was certainly no more than 40 or 50,000 Jewish population there. Then I show the implementation of the Balfour Declaration. And here you just have to, it's such a contentious subject, the Arab-Israel conflict in the Middle East, you just have to sort of hold onto your seat in a way and read the relatively short section on how the British government decided, ironically, much influenced by Arnold Toynbee, who was then working in the Foreign Office, the British government decided that democracy had to be set aside in favour of demography. That's to say that Arab representational institutions and Arab self-government had to be set aside until such time as the Jews, who then constituted 10% of the population, constituted 51%. And only when they constituted 51% could there be representative institutions, in which of course there would be a Jewish majority. And this was not merely the product of a Foreign Office paper, of which Toynbee was one of the authors, but it was part and parcel of the 1922 White Paper, known as the Churchill White Paper, and it was also part and parcel of the evidence presented to the Peel Commission, the secret evidence, which I published in extenso. It was never published at the time. The secret evidence presented to the Peel Commission by both Lloyd George and Churchill as to what they had intended with regard to the question of the demographic balance. And if you look at the debates on the Atlantic Charter, which was the great wartime charter establishment after the war, self-government, one man, one vote would be applied universally, you will see that the British government excluded Palestine from the Atlantic Charter on the argument that there still was not a Jewish majority, and that if the Atlantic Charter were applied in Palestine after the war, there would then be an Arab state, which would, on the determination of every Arab statesman, immediately call a halt to any further Jewish immigration. So this question of holding off democracy, self-government, or whatever it was that was emerging elsewhere, until the demographic balance was changed, was central to British policy until 1939, when a new white paper and a new concept came into being. And I show in the book how the new concept, the MacDonald White Paper, the white paper which was presented by Malcolm MacDonald, who was a successor of Churchill at the Colonial Office, stated that there would be essentially no more Jewish immigration, a maximum of 100,000 Jews, and that 5 years after the passing of the White Paper through Parliament, that's to say, in May 1944, whoever was the majority would then form a government. That's to say, there would be an Arab majority government in May 1944. And again, the ironies of history are such that the person who was responsible for the Churchill White Paper, which established the exact opposite, was Prime Minister, and so in May 1944 he simply informed the War Cabinet that the policy approved by Parliament, over which he actually had no authority to reverse, would not be put into effect. So up to 1944, beyond of course, the British government adhered to this concept that it would hold the democratic balance until the demographic balance had changed. Another feature of the pre-state period, and I think it's central to understanding the situation today, and it's also central for understanding the Palestinian Arab situation today. I've discussed this with a number of leading senior Palestinian Arabs. The Zionists decided that they would establish what were called Jewish national institutions, or national institutions. So although Britain ruled and Britain was in charge of defense and foreign or colonial policy, the Jewish Agency, which was a body established by the British government to be its liaison with the Jews of Palestine, would establish all the elements, if you like, of statehood. Every ministry, every government department, control of education, control of health, so there was a Jewish education system, a Jewish health system, and indeed even foreign affairs and so on. And this is essentially, those of you who've been to Jerusalem and been to the Palestinian headquarters there, Orient House, that is where the equivalent of the Jewish national institutions exist today, and of course after the autonomy they are now operational in the seven cities and indeed in much of the in most of the villages. And the Palestinian Arabs have understood and have in many ways modeled themselves on the Jewish national institutions, which flourished or were established in the 1920s and continued until 48, and were not only the as it were the the way through which the Palestinian Jews became educated and maintained their health and so on, but they were also the way in which individuals obtained the experience which then enabled them to become the ministers of foreign affairs and ministers of health, ministers of education, treasurers and so on, after independence. So that, I think, is central. And it's also important because in 1937, 1938, the British government toyed with the idea of establishing two states in Palestine, a Jewish state and an Arab state. And this was only made possible, according to those who devised it in London, because of the existence of these Jewish national institutions and the stage of development which they had written by that time. There's an unfortunate footnote to all this. I mean, in my book it's not a footnote, it's an integral part of the text, but when the Jewish Agency was established, at the beginning of the mandate, the British had intended it to be parallel with an Arab agency, which would have the same relationship with the British government and would also be able to develop the same institutions. And the Palestinian Arab leadership, which had just changed shortly before the British proposal, rejected this, and, you know, one doesn't like to play the game of the mistakes made by Palestinian Arab leaders, but undoubtedly this was a turning point for them, and therefore they were excluded, and the Jewish national institutions made, if one can use the word, the running. There's one other element of British contribution which I bring in, and that is the question of self-defense of the Jewish national institutions and the Jewish settlements throughout the country. And you, as you'll see in the book, year by year I tell the story of these settlements, where they were, what they were, how they were established, who established them, even something of the history of their names and of the different ideologies behind them. And they were, particularly from 1936, under attack or harassment. And I don't think one can stress too much the part which Lord Wingate played, a British officer, in encouraging Jewish self-defense and in devising what were essentially quite aggressive tactics of defense. In other words, the famous Wingate night squads, from which almost all the future Israeli generals gained their experience. So that, I think, was also a British contribution. With the White Paper and with the change in 1939, I can't enter into now, but I do enter it into the book. And not only did British policy become hostile to certainly the pace of Zionist enterprise, but it was perceived to be totally inimical to it. And this question of perception, which is the point Rabin was trying to make in 75 and made so forcefully in 92. If you perceive yourself to be aggrieved, you can turn that into a policy, into a way of life, into a mindset. And if you look at the trials of the terrorists who were caught committing terrorist acts, you see that there is a tremendous amount of this perception and misperception. The murderers of Lord Moyne were convinced that Moyne had said that he was against Jews coming into Palestine. They produced incredible versions of crude remarks that he had made. In fact, at the time Moyne was murdered, he was waiting for a visit by Dr. Weizmann, who was in London, whom Churchill had arranged to go out to Cairo, because in those days travel was not as easy as it is now. The war was on. Because Moyne had come to the conclusion, no doubt encouraged by Churchill and others in the war cabinet, particularly N.S. Amery, had come to the conclusion that that a Jewish state was the way forward, a Jewish and an Arab state in Palestine. And Churchill had said to Weizmann, I'd like you to go out to Moyne, to see Moyne, and to work out some of the details and to discuss all this. And it was at that point that Moyne was murdered, as someone who was opposed racially and in terms of his mother's milk to Jewish aspirations. I deal, of course, in the book with the immediate post-1945 period, which was a low point in Anglo-Zionist and indeed in Anglo-Jewish relations. And it was interesting during the visit of Robin Cook the other day, that many of the placards against him refer back to this period, to the 1945-1948 period. But as I pointed out to the man who followed him last week, as well as those who were demonstrating against Cook, was another group of demonstrators, Israelis, supporting Cook on Har HaHamah, and one of those supporting the British stand was the daughter of a man who had fought with the British Army in 1919.
But with them, we're in sound economic hands.
Not a bit of it. I think all of us want to see people in this country do well. What people are worried about is insecurity. Over nearly 10 million people have had a spell of unemployment since the last election. They're worried about the fact that this government hasn't addressed some of the long-term fundamental problems, the need to ensure that we've got a well-educated, adaptable and skilled workforce. They're concerned that this country, in prosperity terms, we've slipped during the term of this government's office from 13th to 18th place. This government simply operates on short-term strategy. Typically, you find today that Kenneth Clark takes two or three lines out of the IMF report and then rushes off before people look at the fine details.
Well,
people are bound to be concerned about the state of the public finances.
People might say, Mr. Darling, that's just what you've done, but there we must leave it. Alistair Darling, thanks very much.
19 minutes to nine. We're just getting reports that the Israeli army has sealed off the West Bank. Two people were killed west of Jerusalem earlier on. Stephen Sacker is on the line from Jerusalem. Tell me more, Stephen.
Well, John, the closure of the West Bank, which had been slightly eased over the last week or so, is now back in full force. The Israeli army has announced that the total closure of the West Bank has been reimposed, and workers, those few thousand Palestinian workers who'd been allowed back into Israel in the last few days, were told this morning, having entered Israel, that they had to return immediately. They were ordered back into the West Bank. So the closure is back on, and all because of this drive-by shooting last night, which left two Israelis dead and another critical.
Moshe Dayan and his daughter, Yael. '67 is naturally central to the unfolding story and to the story as I try to tell it. The burdens and curses and excesses of occupation, which undoubtedly created, brought into being inadvertently, an Israel which was not at all in the minds of the founding fathers, but also led through violence, through intifada, to the dramatic changes that have taken place in the last few years. Rabin came to power in 1992, and in an incredible speech in the Knesset, which was listened to with amazement by the Knesset members, I've spoken to many of them, almost all of them actually, who heard it, he set out this vision of an Israel which would do the right thing, would behave according to the tenets of democracy and human rights, which were a concern of his, despite some perceptions to the contrary by people, and which had no claims on the world other than the claims of its behavior from day to day. And it's extraordinary that within 2 years the famous White House handshake had taken place and the process of autonomy was underway. I lead that as far as it can be led. And that is, I suppose, the high point, the Casablanca Conference, when the Israeli government, Rabin and Peres, acting together, presented the vision, which seemed at that point to be much more than a vision, it seemed to be an imminent reality, of a political settlement which would be followed by the equivalent of the European Union, a single economic region. And incidentally, just the other day, there was a strange ripple from Casablanca, didn't get much coverage in the press here, unfortunately, because it was in the midst of the Cook imbroglio. But the Israeli government, Netanyahu's government, transferred to the Jordanians the Sea of Galilee as a water reservoir for Jordan. Is changing the whole extraction of water from the Jordan, so Israel will no longer take water from the sea, but Jordan will dam the river Yarmouk and use the backup of the Yarmouk waters in the Galilee for its own irrigation purposes. This was one of the apparently absurd visions of Casablanca, how Rabin and Peres were mocked at that time by those who didn't like the way they were going. And yet it's been brought in by the Netanyahu government. I was involved slightly in the aftermath of Casablanca, and I remember being present at a meeting between Rabin and the British Prime Minister, at which the question arose, which many Palestinian Arabs have raised, and Arabs beyond Palestine, beyond Israel, and that is the question: if you have an economic unity in the Middle East, does it mean the dominance of Israel? Is it essentially an imperial situation? And I was able to, I did a little paper before one of these talks, and I pointed out that this was a question which had been addressed very seriously in 1917, 1918 and 1919 by the British government from exactly the other perspective. They were then very concerned, particularly Lawrence of Arabia, that the Arab states, Arab nations, Arab entities which were coming into being at that time simply didn't have the resources and the experience. And so under Lawrence's impetus, the British government supported a plan whereby there would be Jewish Zionist presence in Beirut, in Damascus, in Amman, to, as it were, create an economic structure and prosperity. But in the run-up to Casablanca and in the aftermath of Casablanca, I was very impressed by, and I brought this into the book, I got permission to use one of these documents, by the way in which Rabin in particular found this an offensive approach. It was very far from his perception of what there could be. And I remember at one of these meetings, on the table, a whole series of maps of different plans. And in every one, the Israeli government, the Israeli planners under Rabin and Peres' impetus had made sure that there wouldn't be this imperial concept, the idea of joint this and joint that, and that the benefits would somehow not be benefits from which Israel would accrue the greater benefit. And I remember once, you know, one can laugh sometimes at these things, the discussion was centering around tomatoes, and there was Shimon Peres, who I always regard as one of the great men of Israel's history, and there he was talking about growth of tomatoes and the how essential it was that the Palestinian tomato growers would not, as they were at that time, be in a position of dependence upon Israel for the export of tomatoes through Israeli ports. And it was real. It wasn't a joke. It was real. And I see now again, during our Prime Minister's present visit, that this very issue of the export of tomatoes has now moved forward to a much more satisfactory situation. I've mentioned the latest agreement on the Sea of Galilee, and perhaps that's quite a good thing to draw towards a conclusion. Obviously the situation at the moment is not what Rabin and Peres and their government and the Palestinian Arabs with whom they negotiated had intended. And the, not exaggerate, but in a way the guts of the Oslo agreement has been destroyed. The timetable, the territorial progressions have been destroyed by the current Israeli government. At the same time, the Palestinian autonomy is in place. I've been to each of the seven cities, and I've been actually to many small Palestinian towns and villages where the writ of the Palestinian Authority is total, and where there is no presence of Israel. And it always amazes me in Gaza, which I remember so many times as the most militarized city, militarized by Israel, the subject peoples, is now, of course, there's not a single Israeli soldier there. There isn't a considerable military presence, but it is Palestinian. And having followed the Oslo process through, I still find it quite exhilarating to see Palestinian uniforms and realize that, you know, these generals and colonels and sergeants and privates and policemen and naval captains are Palestinians. And on my most recent visit 2 weeks ago, to see that Palestinian number plates, which had been quite rigorously excluded by the government from Israel proper, now are everywhere. So, of course, there's been a massive setback, but, you know, one has to perhaps look at it in Leninist parlance, but it's, you know, one step backwards with all the ideological reasons for it, but probably only a prelude to two steps forward, which, if nothing else, will be the dynamic of history. Thank you.
Any questions?
There's time for questions.
Sir, you made only one reference, like I've seen in your book, about Emmanuel Shinwell and Bibin.
Yes.
In the sort of run-up to 1946-47. And I can remember as a child the tremendous abhorrence of many people in Europe, Italy, France, of what the British were then doing to the refugees who'd landed in, or illegal immigrants to Israel, or Palestine as it then was. Since Shinwell was a Secretary of State for Defence or War, what was his role there?
Fuel and power.
Oh, that's
yeah,
right. Did he not have any interest
yes.
into saying anything?
Right. Well, I deal, I mean, to give me credit, I do deal with illegal immigration at considerable length, both pre-1939, during the war, culminating in the Patria episode, and then after the war. And it's one of my themes in that bit of a book, the bitterness is created by it and the tensions created by the whole illegal immigration situation. Shinwell appears in the story in a very remarkable way. Of course, Shinwell was Jewish, and Zionists in Britain and elsewhere looked to him to be a moderating factor on the British government, particularly in regard to this British refusal, which was never rescinded, to allow some 100,000 Jewish DPs, many of them survivors of the Holocaust, into Britain, something which the American government had its main breach with Britain over. But what I found here in the Public Record Office at Kew were the discussions of a cabinet committee on the future of Britain's oil supplies, which of course doesn't come in the Palestine section of the archival divisions, it comes in fuel. And there it was Shinwell who argued most forcefully that Britain must not open the gates of Palestine to the 100,000 Jews, because this would clearly alienate not the Palestinian Arabs, who were never given any proper weight in British policy at any time, but the Arabs of the states around Palestine, particularly the independent countries of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and always in the British equation, the quote 60 million unquote Muslims on the Indian subcontinent. And Shinwell argued that it was essential, in the light of Britain's struggle with the United States over control of oil and influence in Saudi Arabia, that there should be no concessions made to Zionist pressure. He was lucky, I suppose, Shinwell, that this was a top secret cabinet paper. It was one which was acted upon, was approved by Bevin and approved by Clement Attlee, who was the Prime Minister, another man who was never brought into the equation, though he was the person who made the final decisions. So Shinwell played, you know, a role which he was never recognised for playing, and that was always quite decisive, and it combined, on the one hand, the oil factor, which we have known more recently play a major part in history, and also anti-Americanism, which was an element in the then, but not the present, Labour government's thinking.
In the light of your comments on the Morsi, in the book, do you go into any detail regarding his behaviour in the 1937-45 period, particularly Germany?
Well, I was writing I had to always say to myself, this is a history of Israel. And the history of Israel means the story of how the State of Israel came and how it maintained itself after it came into being. And in that sense, I think the most important part the Mufti played, that Haj Amin played while Mufti, was really making Palestine more central for Muslims worldwide, and also as a nationalist leader. He wasn't entirely successful in creating a unified Palestinian nationalism, but he raised the whole Palestinian national issue to a very high level. So that, I think, in the story of the history of Israel, was really the part. Now, he was a wanted man, the British wanted him, and he escaped from Palestine. And from that point, I think in the history of Israel, he played a relatively little part, until, odd enough, he came back briefly to Gaza and then to Egypt after the war. His wartime activities are, I have mentioned them in other things I've written, dealing with the war. His role in helping to raise the Bosnian SS units, and his constant rather whining complaints to the Nazi authorities against any possible emigration of Jewish children, particularly from Bulgaria, where he played a part, but in fact the Bulgarian Jewish children were never in danger. Fortunately, not in danger. One of my documents, which I'd like to publish one day, though I don't think it had a place in the history of Israel, I mentioned one sentence from it, because that was relevant, and that was the meeting between Hitler and the Mufti, at which the Mufti pleaded the case for the Palestinian Arabs, and Hitler essentially showed no great enthusiasm for it. Though, to be fair to Hitler, he showed so much less enthusiasm to Indian national aspirations when Subhas Chandra Bose came to see him about a week later, that in a sense his mild support for the Mufti, or word saying, well, yes, yes, in due course you'll get it, can, I suppose, be considered some sort of support. When Bose came to see him, he simply said, what India needs is another 100 years of British rule, which was not what Bose was wanting to hear. He didn't know that Hitler had, according to his own account, seen Tales of a Bengal Lancer, the film, 12 times, more than Churchill had seen Lady Hamilton. So in fact, the meeting between them was not, it didn't affect policy any more than his support of Rashid Ali really affected the history of Israel. I mean, it's part of his biography and perhaps a part of a general sort of study of Arab nationalism. But I think he was very impressive in the late 20s and early 30s as the creator of a really bringing Palestine to the center of Muslim thought and aspirations. And that I deal with in the conference which he assembled in Jerusalem of Muslim leaders from all over the world.
May I ask a hypothetical question about recent history, particularly in connection with Rahim and Peerless, whom you mentioned as approval? Between the assassination of Rahim and the defeat of Peerless in the election about 6 months later, there was a spate of Arab terrorist attacks in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. If it hadn't been for these attacks, how do you think the political situation in Israel and the development of the Oslo Agreement would have proceeded?
Well, I deal with that in the book, and in a way I hope I haven't overbalanced the book, but there is considerable weight given to those last, to 92, to last October in the book. Of course it had a dramatic change, not only on the behaviour of the Paris government, which the Lebanese bombing was a part, but also then on the election and the way in which Likud and Netanyahu's coalition partners were able to use that. I remember watching the, shan't make any value judgment, I remember watching the television broadcast beamed to the Russian voters, who were some 750,000 Russians, so they constituted the voting members of the Russian community, a substantial bloc. And that consisted of repeated pictures, looped pictures, of the Jerusalem and Tel Aviv bus bomb carnage, with a political message above it about, you know, only the good and Netanyahu can bring safety. It was quite dramatically exploited. And the other image, some of you may have seen, which was being beyond the Russians, was this incredible picture, rather, of Peres and Rabin, Peres and Arafat going up some steps to a meeting, I think, in Gaza, and then suddenly the glass is shattered. It's like turned into a picture on a desk, the glass picture, and it's shattered, and then again the message, you know, can you trust this man to maintain your security? So undoubtedly it must have had an enormous effect. There are other factors, of course, in the election, which I deal with, but those two bombs are certainly there. I think that the main thing was, and it's very recent history, but it is history, that Rabin and Peres, I remember after the Bet Lid bomb, Rabin was then in London and had to return to Israel. He was negotiating here. And I remember that day very vividly. He was so emphatic, although, you know, he was shaken by the event. It had just taken place and he had to return. He'd come and offered him a plane and the whole thing was chaotic. But he was even then emphatic that such acts must not be allowed to derail or suspend or halt the peace process at all. They were the very reason why it had to go ahead. And Peres followed that line. But in the end it proved untenable, or probably proved untenable for the voters. But there, you know, we have our own problems with elections and the demography of elections. To this day, since the last election, the Israel Labour Party is the largest single party in the Israel Parliament, and the prime ministerial vote, a novelty in Israeli constitution, was very, very narrow indeed. So even with those bombs, it was an extremely close result, and one which has created a situation not unlike in some aspects what happens in the United States, where the largest single party in the Knesset is not part of the government, and a coalition has been formed around it whereby it becomes a minority. My notes, my last word was the future, and then while I was having a cappuccino next door I crossed it out. I haven't got a celestial eye and I'm not a prophet. I mentioned the very end, which I don't think was meant to be an escape clause, but, you know, the dynamic of history. I am optimistic. I mean, I know some of the people who are conducting these negotiations, and their characters, and I know the situation on the ground. There is so much in favour of finding a way not to continue on a downward spiral. I'm sure that will happen. Of course, this is all tied up totally now with Palestinian history, and it is another story and another book or another whole sequence of perspectives. I've been present with Arafat on two occasions when he set out his stall, if you like, and it seemed to me remarkably similar in some respects to what might have been a Zionist presenting a similar stall of different periods. I remember how the British government was always demanding of the Zionist leaders that they eliminate Jewish terrorism, and I remember how the Zionist leaders made every effort to do so. And one of the most difficult periods in Israel's history, in fact there are two separate periods, is what is known as the saison, the season, when the Jewish agency informed the British exactly where hundreds of terrorists were in hiding and they were subsequently arrested. And in a way this is the dilemma which now faces Arafat. He's under great pressure from Israel and from others to act against terrorists, and he is. And at the same time, like the Jewish Agency in 1938 and again in 1946, that becomes in itself a controversial matter, both with regard to the outside world and with regard to his own people. But I'm very impressed by the benefits of Oslo on the ground. I'm quite staggered by the way in which all sorts of projects, despite the current political problems, I'm not just talking about Israeli-Jordanian, which are another matter, but Israeli-Palestinian projects do advance. And it seems painfully slow, but I mean, pre-Oslo was 1992, and we haven't yet reached the end of, we're not 10 years on from pre-Oslo. And I've no doubt that things of great importance, such as the Gaza port and the Gaza airport, and the territorial percentages, will be resolved increasingly in favour of an acceptable Israeli-Palestinian arrangement. I was never one to like the concept of the final status, but Rabin and Peres and their advisors understood that nothing less would be acceptable to the Palestinians. You couldn't have a constantly open-ended agreement, even if it had staged benefits and staged developments. So there is a final status concept. The present Israeli government are nervous of it, but they're committed to it. And a factor which didn't exist when the Zionists were in a sort of similar stage of being underdogs is that there is now the United States, there is the European Union, which have taken away from the United Nations, which I suppose essentially was in this issue always a talking shop. They've taken it away, and there are. They are very strong at the moment. If you look at the public orations and public positions of the United States and Britain, they're very different to the equivalent in 30 years ago. They are the positions of governments which believe they can influence both sides to move forward. And again, if you look back at Madrid, where the Israeli government and both the Likud and subsequent Labour governments were emphatic that there could not be a settlement except between Palestinians and Israelis, that the outside world was not welcome. And you had all this extraordinary sort of charades of, Russia and the United States being allowed to turn up but then having to disappear from the negotiations. And many of the bilateral negotiations, which I deal with in the book, the Madrid bilaterals, did move forward on water, environment and so on, in Tokyo, Moscow, they were effective. But now it seems this idea, we don't need you, we don't want you, which existed on both sides, though it was particularly strong on the Israeli side, that I think has now gone. And that must be an optimistic factor. Okay.
Prime Minister Blair,
Prime Minister
Martin, you mentioned early on in your talk that the Arabs, even before 1912, demanded the halt of Jewish invasion.
Yes.
Who would they have demanded it from? And who controlled the invasion then?
Well, the Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire, for all its faults, had a parliament. This was, of course, the period after the Young Turk Revolution, and the Turkish constitution was in place. And they demanded it in the parliament. They demanded it on the hustings, and they demanded it in the parliament. And they had a certain success. Of course, the Ottoman Turks, who were not an emphatic governing instrument generally, really responded by what, in the British Mandate days, were temporary suspensions of immigration. But there were periods when new immigration was forbidden, and the device which the Zionists and Jews generally, because not all the Jews there were Zionists, got around was to become to be protected by a foreign power, to go as Russian or British citizens, even as American citizens. And the Ottoman Parliament had no control over those communities which were established. Incidentally, here's a historical curiosity. We're very careful about history. But one of the debates that still was presented to Mr. Blair last week, that in the Balfour Declaration, Britain had made its pledge to the Jews to establish a Jewish national home in Palestine, and then there is the clause, which everybody knows, and which says, but this is not to be at the expense of the existing communities in Palestine. The phrase existing communities in those days, it was meant to refer, in the negotiations, it's clear it doesn't refer to the Palestinian Arabs, as I say, got really no help from anybody at that time. It refers to the other protected communities in Palestine, in other words, the Christian communities and the communities which had foreign protection, that they should not have any disabilities vis-a-vis a Jewish national home. In other words, they shouldn't have any diminution of whatever communal rights they had. And it's interesting, I bring it in to a certain extent in the book, because it's an important question, but it will also make a very important book on its own. The debate within the Zionist movement with regard to the Palestinian Arabs, with regard to this enormous majority. Of course, the land generally was emptier than it is today, but there was this substantial Palestinian majority, there were Palestinian towns and villages and large villages and so on. And this was a vigorous debate inside the Zionist movement. And I suppose, to put it in its simplest terms, there were those Zionists who understood that they would have to make some concessions to this fear among the Arabs that they were going to be eventually outnumbered and overrun. And there were very interesting debates in the Jewish Agency archives where members of the agency are opposed even to the land purchase policy, which went under several phases, but particularly the consolidated land purchase policy, because they said it is too, you know, it is in a way detrimental to the Arabs. And if you remember, quite a lot of land was purchased from Arabs in the coastal plain, and they were then moved to the Jordan Valley, to the Baysan area. And there were Zionists who didn't like this, who felt, you know, although there was land, and this transfer took place without violence, I mean, it wasn't the cause of aggravation, but there were those who felt it was wrong. So this has always been a debate. Of course, the Palestinian Arabs, this is a newish term, and at the time, the what is now the Palestinian Arab cause was much weakened by the fact that there was really no central political body.
Can I ask, in a sense, how you work? By that I mean, are you an academic, or were you an academic? Did you have research facilities for a while? Do you operate with an enormous private team like Randolph Churchill did? And you attended these various meetings with the Prime Minister and other people. Are you there as an observer under sufferance, social right history, or are you also a political advisor amongst other things?
Well, I'll try and read this. The first question, how I write, I don't have any research assistants. I suffered for almost 5 years as one of Randall's team. I mean, it had its compensations, but the resulting work had no cohesion, because each researcher has his own perception, and if you go through the archives which a researcher has gone through, you will find other things. And I've in any case always felt that if anybody is competent to do my research, they're competent to do it for themselves. Why should I be the beneficiary? So things take longer. As to whether I have an academic appointment, I taught at Oxford from 1960 until 1970. Two or three, and then I had to give it up because of the Churchill work. I completely blotted my copybook when I turned down a Rhodes scholar who wanted to study diplomacy with me, who subsequently had a political career of some impact. And eventually my college, Merton, said that I could just become a researcher with no obligations, no salary, and if I came to lunch with them from time to time, they'd be glad to see me. and I moved to London to work in the public record office and to live here on the train that goes to the public record office. And that's it. So I really haven't taught except 2 years ago when UCL lost a professor in somewhat unusual circumstances at the beginning of term, and they asked me if I would teach for the year, which I did. So that's the only teaching I've ever done. And because the professor disappeared but didn't give up his professorship or his salary, I didn't even get a professorship. I was just a visiting. Terribly depressed. I was just a visiting professor. So that is that. As to these peregrinations, I asked myself the question. Well, I certainly wasn't a historian. The first Prime Minister with whom I worked was Harold Wilson. And since then, I've never known a Prime Minister who has any interest at all in a historian, in what you sort of postulate as a historian sitting there and writing down the words of wisdom, or generally sort of being in attendance for the future. It doesn't seem to be a concept which politicians really have. And one could write an interesting study on why that is the case. I even remember once with Harold Wilson, some important handwritten letter had come, and he read it out to the two or three people in the room, and there was general comment, and then he made whatever his decision was, and he crumpled it up in his hand and threw it in the paper basket. And I said, in all the innocence, I was a little younger then, I spoke perhaps out more, and I said, Prime Minister, what about the archive? And he looked at me with a bewilderment and said, the waste paper basket is my archive. And although that, I don't think, was the view of any of his successors, somehow that was always a feature. I don't know what my role was in the middle. Of course, I tried to prepare papers in advance. I was involved in one very bizarre episode when the original, it must have been in the second Rabin visit here, the issue at that time was joint Israeli-Arab activities generally. And all sorts of plans were produced for, well, one I think is coming into effect, an electricity grid which would cover all the countries, and all sorts, and the water project, of which this Galilee is a rather dramatic recent development. And anyway, I prepared various maps, and I had a son, he was then, I suppose, about 12, and he's very interested in maps, 11 or 12, and he produced a beautiful map of a hydrofoil surface from Alexandria to Iskenderun, via Gaza, Tel Aviv, Beirut, Latakia, and so on, which of course the distances are too small to have hydrofoils just on the Israeli bit or the Lebanese bit or the Syrian bit, but it would make a wonderful sort of thing. And by sheer accident, this hydrofoil map got into my files, got into my bundle, and the next thing I knew, it was actually on a table being discussed. And if things had moved at the pace Perry's always dreamed of, perhaps there would even now be a hydrofoil surface. I sat in, and I, you know, at the end I took copious notes, and once or twice I was able to say something. I mean, normally just sort of a question of interpreting. And then afterwards discuss it. I know it was interesting. Then Mr. Mandelson asked a question about it in the House of Commons, and that someone put the kibosh on it, you know, who was paying, and who paid the hotel bill, and who paid the plane fares. Not Pritchard. No, anyway, it led to a rather unfortunate... It's very difficult. I mean, I did get an impression of how policy is made, and also sometimes of how it's not made. I never forget once in one of these Middle Eastern meetings, Rabin was explaining, and I was writing it down. He was explaining to John Major his perception of Palestinian nationalism. It was very interesting, and you know, and suddenly the door opened, and some official came in and said, "Prime Ministers, it's 6 o'clock. Time for the photo call." And you know, that was it. And Rabin ended in mid-sentence, my notes ended in mid-sentence, because after the photo call was a press conference, after the press conference was a dinner, after the dinner was a helicopter ride somewhere, and it never finished. And I remember thinking, that must happen again and again. But on the other hand, I was impressed enormously by everybody's sort of sense of the seriousness of it and the application and on. You know, there weren't many moments of levity or trivia. You know, even after sometimes it's 16 or 17 hour, you know, unbroken. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the book and I hope it answers even more questions.
Thank you very much, Martin Gilbert, for a very informative evening. If you'd like to read more, your ticket entitles you to £2 off the price of the book this evening. And if you'd like to hear more, I think Dr. Brian on the seats for listings of various events to come. And if you can keep it in your mind in July, it would help.